operations in the hearing.
I'll continue with my legal submissions. I think I read up to paragraph 4.9.
Yes, that's right.
On page 14. So now I turn to just some specific definitions that have been addressed by submitted evidence that has been filed with the panel, and essentially the purpose is to explain what was an issue and generally what is now agreed. Mostly, which is positive. So in terms of antenna and mast, the Fifth Sullivan sought changes to these two definitions to ensure that the rules in 30.4.41 through to 30.4.50 are not limited to telecommunication activities. These rules were relocated through the course of the utilities hearing. They were relocated within the chapter. But the content remains as notified. Although the merits of what has been suggested by Ms. O'Sullivan is expected, and it was not the intention of the rules to be limited to telecommunication activities, this is an unfortunate consequence of the notified rules and definitions and has not been submitted on. Consequently, amendments to the definitions of antenna and mast ensure that radio communication, navigation, all meteorological communication activities are also included in the definitions. That is a matter that may need to be rectified through stage two, and that is because of that scope at present. Just a minor correction to the legal submission, so we just delete the footnote 46. Now, my apologies.
Okay. Wouldn't it be simpler for that definition to just refer to radio transmission of the same? Because all of those activities rely on transmission and receipt of radio waves of different lengths. It doesn't matter what purpose those waves are put to, does it? Whether they're for navigation purposes, for telecommunication purposes, for television, radio, or whatever. It's a simple matter of physics. It's a mass that produces radio waves.
Yes, yes, I keep what you're saying. And to look for a solution in terms of making the changes needed. That was the definition that was notified, of course, that
was a problem. I think, to be fair, I think part of the problem with some of these is that council have overanalyzed things rather than looked at the simplest.
Let me take the suggestion on board after the next one. Thank you. Regarding the definition of site, the purpose of these three paragraphs is just to summarise the previous hearings where this definition has been considered, just because it is of relevance to the recommendation in this hearing. So in the subdivision hearing, the panel requested that Mr. Price, who was the Section 42A author, review the definition and in particular clauses B and C, which Mr. Grice then deferred until this hearing. In the residential hearing stream, Ms. Banks addressed the definition in her reply evidence in response to questioning from the panel regarding developments occurring across more than one lot and the intended application of the definition to cross leases, company leases, unit titles and strata titles. In considering both of these issues, Ms. Lee considers that the definition of site as included in the in part operative Auckland Unitary Plan should be used instead of the proposed district plan definition. Although she notes that while the Auckland definition addresses the panel questions to Ms. Banks, it does not address the questions put to Mr. Bryce. The panel's questions to Mr. Bryce concern zone and district boundaries, and whether those boundaries should necessitate a site being considered as two or more sites. Ms. Lee considers that there is no need for a change in zone or boundary at a site to require it to be considered as two or more sites. Consequently, she recommended that B and C in the site definition be deleted. That's on the merits. However, there is no scope within submissions to either replace this, the proposed district plan definition with the Auckland version or to delete the NC. Turning to small
does the council intend to introduce a new definition in stage two or consider that matter?
Yes, the matter's
being
considered
yeah.
in stage two.
I think it's worth noting that it seems to me that I'm reading that definition, it's another case of the council trying to put into the definition rules. And I think the intended rule was to be that where a site is touched by a zone boundary, you have to subdivide down along that zone boundary. I think that's the intention, because it was quite a common rule in district plans in the past. And that it included the definition of site, which is probably not the best place to do it.
Turning to the definition of small cells, and this is the subject of Mr. McCallum-Clark's evidence. So following the council's agreement with the submitters that he represented at Spark and Chorus, that a definition of small cells is required in the proposed district plan, the National Environmental Standard for Telecommunications 2016 has come into force, and the council agreed that the updated definition from the national standard of small cells should be included in the proposed district plan, and therefore updates this recommendation to the version now used in the national standard.
Ms. Scott, since we're drawing a distinction between definitions sought with and without the benefit of a submission, was the original submission from the telcos broad enough that it can accommodate this change?
I believe so. The definition came through a request that might be included in the plan by that very submitter, so yes.
Thank you.
In terms of support structure, Mr. McCallum-Clark's evidence is that this definition seems to be broadened to include telecommunications lines. In Mr. Barr's Section 42A report for Chapter 30, he recommended the inclusion of support structure in Chapter 2. However, at that time, there was also a definition of telecommunication facility, which included associated equipment and support structures. Therefore, there was no need for telecommunication facilities to be added to the definition of support structures. However, through his reply evidence on Chapter 30, Mr. Barr recommended that the definition of telecommunication facility be deleted for other reasons. Consequently, Ms. Leith agrees with Mr. McCallum-Clark's evidence and recommends through his summary that the definition of support structure should be broadened to include telecommunication lines. Regarding Replacement Act, the submitter Patterson Pitts Group sought amendments to the definition of site to reflect Replacement Act or Unit Titles Act 2010. It is respectfully submitted that references in district plans to future legislation is not provided due to uncertainty. In any event, Section 22 of the Interpretation Act provides that references to a repeal enactment as a reference to an enactment that, with or without modification, replaces or corresponds to the enactment repealed. Therefore, if the Act is repealed and replaced by a new Act, then the references to the old Act should be read as references to the new Act. This principle of interpretation resolves the issue of referring to and replacement acts in the definition, and that is not necessary. In addition, and for the same reasons, the reference to the 2008 regulations and the definition of regionally significant infrastructure should be updated to 2015. Turning to retail activity, the evidence for Bunnings Limited confirms that, confirms that Bunnings and the council are in agreement with the definition of trade supplier and building supplier. That as set out in the K-9 evidence, Bunnings seeks to exclude trade suppliers from the definition of retail activity. This commission is a point of difference between the council and Bunnings, and will be addressing more detail in the council's reply.
Scott, I intend to discuss this with Ms. Knight tomorrow, but I'm a bit puzzled where Bunnings are coming from and whether, even if their relief were accepted, they would still have a problem because trade suppliers don't fit within the definition of an industrial activity. It seems the whole objective is in order that they could locate these work at their warehouse within an industrial zone. Can you enlighten me? Should I wait to see what Ms. Knight's answer is?
I can't speak for what Bunnings is thinking through their submission, but we will take your comments on board.
And you will recall also that there's a policy in Chapter 3 that says no non-industrial activities in industrial zones.
And that is derived from a number of environmental cases in this district pointing out the shortage of industrial zones.
Yes. So it seemed to me that if they were successful, they'd fall into a hole. They had something that's neither a retail activity nor an industrial activity. The plan doesn't deal with it all.
It's something that is also going to be relevant in stage two of the review where the industrial zones are notified. And that's something we don't have before us at the moment. But they may be looking to future-proof the definition for stage two, possibly.
I think they might have something of a problem if there's a policy sitting in Chapter 3 forestalling that.
Yes, I can't recall the buttons were a part of the Eurosummission on Chapter 3.
I don't think they were because I looked.
Thank you. I'm sure they probably will have to read the transcript before tomorrow.
I do know that they have different consultants now from the consultant that lost his watch the submission. So that may also account for the difference.
Turning to visitor accommodation. So, while the residential visitor accommodation provisions were withdrawn and are intended to be part of stage two of the review, there are still rules related to visitor accommodation in stage one. Rural town centres and special zones. And the definition is also included in Chapter 2. The Council respectfully notes that amendments to the definition will have an effect on the Stage 2 process and heard the fairest that we could draw that to your attention. But Ms. Link has addressed the submissions of the definition that do not impact upon the number of nights. And it is that specific matter which is relevant to stage two. Ms. Lisa addressed this more in her evidence summary, and I note that it's also her view that, that she thinks the number of nights is something probably for a matter for the rules rather than the definition itself.
I think, though, it is a matter of the definition because isn't the point of the definition to distinguish between short-term use of an accommodation unit and long-term use, which is rental, in the 90 days, is that distinguishing point. And it's not. There are several other components of the definition, which are for some rating purpose, but I think the fundamental definition is that it's for 90 days or less. Has to remain part of the definition.
Yes, and her recommendation is that it does remain part of the definition at the time. I guess my submission is that some caution needs to be taken to removing that at a point in time when that the subject matter is a important subject matter that is going to be notified at stage two. At that time, obviously, the Council could look at ways of addressing any changes that are needed, whether it be through a variation But at this point in time, that's her recommendation, that the 90 days remains, and that there isn't any evidence before her that points her to change her recommendation. Turning now to the last category, which is the submissions on the whole of plan, there was one statement of evidence filed in this category, and that is Mr. Paul for the Upper Environmental Society. I just briefly wish to address some issues that have been raised by his evidence. First, Mr. Hall has attempted to remedy deficiencies in what has been categorised as a whole plan submission by providing detail now as to what should have been provided in the original submission. The provision of that information at this point in the hearing process does not get around the procedural fairness and natural justice issues raised by Mr. Section 42A report. The scope of the submission cannot be widened to providing subsequent evidence, as there is no way for further submitters to have reasonably known at the time the submission was lodged what the submission was seeking and whether they should seek to join the debate through lodging a further submission. In addition, Mr. Paul is seeking to relitigate some matters that have already been covered in the earlier hearing streams. The content and merit of the chapters mentioned in this evidence have already been heard, and it is respectively submitted that the content and merit of these chapters is not a matter for this hearing panel. While it is noted that the structure of the entire plan, I say in May, being a matter for this hearing panel, I'm talking about the order of chapters, the existence and merit of a chapter itself was required to be brought before or through the relevant hearing stream. And I just note there that I believe Mr. Hall did provide evidence at each of the hearings that he has provided further comments on in this statement of evidence. And that brings me to the end of my written submissions. So unless you have any further questions, Mr. Robinson.
Three questions. First of all, can I ask you two points arising out of a very helpful memorandum you filed at our request on the National Policy Statement on Urban Development Capacity. In paragraph 14 of that memorandum, it said that Council's not in a position to, at this point, to give evidence or submissions confirming the stage one test gives effect to the nominated policies. Question for you is, when will it be in a position to give us a response on those?
So this memorandum, perhaps not clearly enough, given your question, Dean went on to indicate that the work or the upgrade or the update of the dwelling capacity model is continuing, and that the intention is that evidence will be brought to the rezoning hearing, and then the memorandum went on to request an extension to the timetable of filing that evidence, given that the council will not be able to need the evidence in due date, and I believe that a minute was issued in the act of speech.
So the answer is it will be done through the evidence on the revised DCM?
Yes, that is the intention. Of course, where it can in terms of dwelling capacity, some of these policies talk about providing additional and even further work that the council doesn't need to do until the end of 2018. The council is not going to be in a position to provide evidence to the extent that the NPS contemplates in a few months. It will be continuing to work to the NPS timeframe. So the evidence that is the subject of your minute, that relates to dwelling capacity within the district, but the NPS does go a further step, and it talks about taking into account monitoring and all those types of things in terms of providing a comprehensive assessment. I think the date is December 2018.
And the second point is, arising out of this memorandum, is that I infer that we should proceed on the basis that our town is not an urban environment for the purposes of the NPS, but I just wanted to check that. You said that we should infer the contrary for Queenstown and Wanaka.
And
while you're doing that, my assumption would be that Arrowtown would be, if Arrowtown is not, then we could safely assume that Lake Harvey Township, Glenorchy, Luggett are all not in that category. Thank you. And the last point relates to your appendix on scope. And again, this may be my confusion. I'll look at the last paragraph about collective scope. And in particular, the last sentence of the last paragraph. Because that didn't accord with my recollection of submissions that you and your colleague, Mr. Winchester, gave on the Stream 1 hearings, I went and read your reply on Stream 2, which I wasn't present at, and it seemed to me that this didn't accord with what you said then either. I'll explain to you what I read from those submissions and invite you to tell me the point I'm missing. I understood you to be saying, firstly, that the panel's scope is defined by all submissions. Secondly, that the scope for any one submitted to appeal was defined by their submission. And thirdly, that any submitter could bring evidence on any point and have it considered, provided it was in the scope of a submission, not necessarily their own. That's what I read your submissions in both Stream 1 and Stream 2 to be saying, but I read the last sentence of your paragraph 3.4 is saying the last of those is not correct.
What you're saying is correct. I picked this up on the plane on the way down as well. The submissions that we've advanced in strategic directions and the rural hearing as you have described, your 3 points. But just to add to that, there was one additional submission that we are submitted, which is to produce evidence that goes beyond the relief they have addressed in their submissions or further submissions. They are entitled to do so, and the panel is entitled to receive that evidence, but it becomes a matter of weight to be given to that evidence when it's something the submitter has not submitted on.
And I have cheerfully taken the view that whether the submitter can or cannot appeal will be someone else's problem.
Quite important one for us.
Important for the council, but not for us.
So, I think that brings me to the end, unless Mr. Chair has any questions.
No,
so we will call Ms. Bowline first to make her question 42A report on the application. I recommend that the framework and the structure of Chapter 28 should be retained as notified. However, I do recommend a number of changes to the provisions shown in the redrafted chapter. The changes I recommend refine the relevant objectives of policies rather than fundamentally altering the approach of the notified provision. Of note, I now recommend A, increasing the consistency of language used throughout the notified series of objectives and policies, such as use of the concepts of tolerance and significant risk, to reduce uncertainty as to how policies would be applied to increase and to increase consistency between policies. C, acknowledging that regionally significant infrastructure has locational, technical and operational requirements, which may require a more flexible approach to the consideration of natural hazard risk. C, ensuring that the level of detail in natural hazard assessment is commensurate to the level of risk. And D, opportunities to increase alignment with our target of regional policy statements and decision solutions, bearing in mind the uncertainty over the CRPS due to the current appeal process. In the next section, I just responded to the three statements of evidence that I have seen at the time of writing the summary. And the others that have been received subsequently, I need to respond to them on reply. Three statements of evidence have been filed relating to Chapter 28, which I wish to briefly comment on, noting that I will do my opportunity to respond in further detail and reply. Ms. Black from Real Journeys Limited supports the Chapter 28 policies that allow existing activities to continue in areas subject to natural hazard risk and that provide for development to occur where and when the natural hazard risk is not significantly increased. No further relief was sought by Ms. Black. Mr. Williams for Queenstown Park and Remarkables Park, which is FS111 series, generally supports the changes recommended in the Section 42A report with two further elements of the research which I support. These are A, that the words all mitigated are removed from objectives 28.3.2 to avoid confusion as to whether risk management and risk mitigation are mutually exclusive concepts. And B, that the words of damage in policy 28.3.1.1 are removed after the words human life. In my view, this is a minor non-substantive change that would improve the wording of the redrafted policy. Mr. Handley, for the Otago Regional Council, is supportive of the direction of the changes recommended in the Section 42A report. Helpfully, Mr. Handley has provided the IRC's position on each of the individual provisions in the redrafted chapter, and he has briefly noted some further changes that the IRC are pursuing. My view on the further relief sought by Mr. Handley is as follows. A. Objective 28.3.1. Mr. Handley points out that the use of minimised in the PRPS is subject to appeal. be a request that the PUD use whatever terms are resolved through the DRPS process. I refer to Council's legal submissions, where I understand that the correct legal test for the application of the PRTS is still to have regard to. In the context of the current legal test and the present uncertainty on account of appeal, I recommend that no amendment is made in the state. Six. Policy 28.3.1.3. I agree that it would be appropriate to replace the word landowner with the word community, and I agree that the state would reinforce that tolerance is assessed at a community level rather than at an individual level. C. Policy 28.3.2.1. I support amending the policy to state avoid significantly increasing risk, as this change would increase consistency with PRPs and would still enable the ability for redevelopment to occur in areas where there is a risk of presence. If my recommendation to include the word increasing in the policy is accepted, then I also recommend accepting deletion of the words acknowledging that this will not always be practical in developed areas, given the shift in focus of the policy from avoiding significant risk to avoiding significantly increasing risk. I consider that these changes remain consistent with the approach outlined in paragraph 9.15 of my section 42A report, and they remain consistent with the approach to 49 of SLAC. D. Policy 28.3.2.2. I recommend accepting replacement of the word unacceptable with intolerable. I accept that using the word intolerable will increase consistency of the term used in Chapter 28 and increase alignment with the PRPs. I also accept the change sought to amend the final bullet point of the policy to include the words remedial works. I consider this to be a minor change to increase alignment with the language used in the PRPs. E. Policy 28.3.2.3. I recommend accepting the reinstatement of the word avoid in the final bullet point of the policy. I agree that if risk cannot be managed to a tolerable level, then avoidance should occur. This is consistent with part of the relief sought by other submissions. Furthermore, consistent with the relief sought by Mr. Williams and the steps of Objective 28.3.2 in paragraph 6 and above, I consider that it would also be appropriate to amend the policy to revoke the word or mitigate. F. Policy 28.3.2.4. I agree that the notified policy does not give full effect to the outcome policy 4.1.10, which provides a more directive framework for the consideration of harm protection instructions, noting, however, that the correct legal test at this stage is to have regard to. In my view, it is questionable as to whether OIG's submission provides sufficient scope to make the requested change. And I intend to interrogate the issue of scope and provide a recommendation to speak of the resource and the right reply. G. Objective 28.3.3. Mr. Hanley requests that this objective is amended to give effect to policy 4.1.2 of the decision version of the PRPs, which requires the assessment of risk likelihood to cover no less than 100 areas. If such relief were to be accepted, in my view, it would be more appropriate to incorporate it into policy 28.3.2.3, which lists the methods to be addressed in natural hazard assessments, rather than objective 28.3.3 as sought by Mr. Hanley. It would be my preference to hear Mr. Hanley speak before forming the final remarks on the errors of this aspect of the hearing. H. Policy 28.3.3.4, I recommend accepting the placement of the word unacceptable with intolerable. Consistent with my recommendation regarding the relief sought policy 28.3.2.2, I accept that using the word intolerable will increase consistency of the terms used in Chapter 28 and increase alignment with the PRPs.
Just
at
the top of the page. Yeah.
Yes, I have one additional matter. In the Scott at paragraph 3.7, she mentions three net flood hazard areas,
yes.
And she's taken this from the section 2 report, and I have since checked the notified map, and those flood areas weren't shown on the notified map. They relate to a township zone, and so they didn't form part of stage 1 of the review.
Right.
So those three areas here that Ms. Scott had mentioned aren't on the notified map.
Okay. So we could just cross out that bit about the exemption.
Yes.
Just on the top of the last page, I'm just interested in the use of language. I'm just wondering how one can interrogate an issue. I can understand waterboarding someone. Or interrogating data, which you used in previous hearings, but an issue.
To take the direction as well, as well as so I'll go back to the original, to the submission, and look at what they've asked for. In my, and I apologise for not looking at this in more detail right now, but I have reread the submission and I don't just mention medication measures or any different treatment of heart protection structures.
I've just got a couple of questions in the section 42A report. On page 18, paragraph 9.3, you say in there, is in no way an absolute prohibition on avoiding risk. And I'm just wondering. I'm just trying to get a handle on the meaning, and I'm wondering whether what you meant to say was it's not an absolute requirement to avoid risk. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. That's
and the other question I have is on page 30. In paragraph 12.8. You've got a double negative in there.
Can you just repeat that, please? I'm just trying to take it up.
Yes, so at paragraph 12.8 of the section 22A report.
Yep.
And so it's replacing the word inaccurately with
tedious. Chair, can I take you first to your paragraph 5.11 of your 42A report? Tell us about the EBU management plans and tell us they're relevant. Is there anything in the plans of relevance to natural hazards that we should know about?
I think you'll find that there is actually another senior management plan not listed there, which is the one on the bluff south of Niue, which is 2013-2014. Maybe you've got the 2008 one, but there's an update to the hearing down there 2 years ago and a very new version in 2015.
So. I think that's correct. That has to be right because I can recall in the Stream 1A hearing Mr. Pickard referred us to both, so it's more than just an update. I think there must be separate plans. He said there were three.
Yeah.
Now, paragraph 5.15, talking about the decisions version and the changes there too. I've noted the section 32 analysis of natural hazards said that the proposed RPs had a more cautious view of natural hazards than did the PDP and identified that the PDP was seeking to avoid significant risk, and indeed that the council would seek to shift that. Now, my reading of paragraph 41, policy 416 of the proposed RFP is that that didn't change, and it's still seeking to avoid significant increases in natural hazard risk. And am I correct that your answer to that, based on your summary, is to shift the PDP further towards that position?
That's correct. So the Section 32 was written prior to the proposed RFS being notified. So at that stage it was in draft form. So, but I wasn't the author of the Section 32 or the chapter. But it's my understanding that it was written prior to notification of the proposed RFS.
Now, paragraph 520 I got a little confused with this discussion, because my reading of policy 4.5.1C of the proposed RPS is that it just talks about future growth areas in existing rural areas. So I wonder if the practicality problem that you've identified is actually raised by that policy, given that it's talking about greenfield development.
Yes, no, you're right. So, and my position has shifted in terms of my response to the release brought by the Regional Council to policy 28.2.2.1, which is marked up in the later version of the recommended revised chapter, where we're avoiding significantly increasing risk rather than avoiding significant risk.
So that comes to the same circle. The focus is on increasing risk.
That's right. And it has been a bit of a, I guess, a movable feast through this process and what Chapter 28 is trying to address. And I feel now that we've been changing that policy to 28.3.2.1 really clarifies and aligns it with the relevant proposed new policies, which talk about increasing risk rather than avoiding significant.
Right. And I know that Council discussed this, but in terms of 524, saying significant risk hasn't been defined, and as I said, is the effect of the objectives and policies related to natural hazards. But the question is, in looking at the rural areas, and this is another side to the question I asked Ms. Scott. Do you have a feel for where the rural areas that are the subject of significant hazard risk are? Just how much of the rural areas of the district are the subject of significant risk. Like accepting that there is some uncertainty as to what we mean by that term.
Right, and it's one of the constraints arising from the early decision not to make any more hazardous finished route plans is that we haven't assessed the significance of risk and matter yet. So the information that's held in the Natural Hazards Database is a repository for natural hazards information, but it's not it hasn't been interrogated in such a way that will tell you what level of risk necessarily the hazard poses. It's there to highlight to you that there is a natural hazard, and as a specific to raise flags, and then it's interrogated further through the consent process and the assessment will be required as part of that process. And the OIC and the Commission have submitted that they support that approach to using the database.
Does the database include the reports that are lodged? I know that there are some that the council has specifically obtained, and there are reports lodged on resource consent.
Yes.
So all of those can be extracted from the database, can they?
That's right. So to collect information, reports that were commissioned by the OIC, by the OIC, and there are instances where a report has come in with a resource consent, and then that information has been uploaded into the database. Whether or not that practice is ongoing is unclear. And that is part of the rationale for the amendment that I'm recommending to policy 28.3.3.1 to replace the word basis with consideration.
What was that reference number, please?
28.3.3.1. You asked Ms. Scott about whether or not there's a public process for people to influence the information that goes into the database. There isn't a formal process currently.
What was that, sorry?
You asked Ms. Scott.
Yeah, I got the question, what was the answer?
So the answer is that there is no formal process currently. And in my view, going forward, there should be a more robust process.
Take it back, please, to your suggestions about 28.3.2.1 and 28.3.2.2. I think that, in particular, the first bullet point, as I see it, that these are two sides of the same coin. First, avoid significantly increasing natural hazard risk, and then enable something which it does not increase natural hazard risk to an intolerable level. Are we promoting sort of some room for argument that there is some space between those two points?
Yeah.
Should they have the same language? Would be. So that they are a match.
Can I have a think on the wording there and come back to that?
Certainly. And the next question about enabling subdivision and development of land subject to natural hazards where it does not do one of the listed things. My immediate reaction is that there might be any number of reasons why subdivision and development might not be enabled. that are not related to to natural hazards, starting with the fact that subdivision and development might be proposed in O&Ls, for instance. And so I wondered whether, rather than either allow or enable, it would, and I don't know whether the scope for this, I haven't checked the submissions, it would be better as not preclude. Because effectively you're saying that notwithstanding these hazard conditions, that won't be a reason in terms of policy to prevent subdivision development. But as I say, there might be any number of other reasons not to permit it. So can I invite you to think about that?
Thank you.
Now, it's 10.2 of your 42A report. Just write this down. Make sure I can capture my I was puzzling over the submission, and I was wondering, are the submitters actually concerned about natural hazards created by the aquifer? Is that where they're coming from? Like, it's difficult because they haven't filed any evidence, and I have to confess that reading this last night, I should have gone back and reread the submission myself. But it, just from your summary of it, it doesn't seem to be a natural hazard issue. Well, like,
I think it is in a roundabout way. But I did grapple with it as well, as to whether or not the aquifer itself was a hazard, or if it was the earthworks exposing the aquifer which were causing the flooding hazard.
You might like to explain a little bit further, Commissioner Robinson. He's not as familiar with the issue of pea gravel and water.
Yeah. And I'm not an expert in geomorphology.
Is this about flooding?
It's to do with flood hazard. So where you're exposed to the aquifer, then that can cause a flood hazard.
That's good enough. So, yeah. So yes, it is a natural hazard issue.
Correct.
Your paragraph 11.9. Answering a different point to the one that the submitter was making. The submitter was seeking that you only focus on significant risks. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that in part you're agreeing because you're now focusing on significant increases in risk. But you're also saying it's better to, that the significance of a risk is informed by an assessment. And I don't think the submitters are contesting that. They're saying you shouldn't worry about it, hazard risks that are not, quote, significant. So if I'm right and you're addressing a different point, what's your answer to that? If I'm correct in my understanding where this is coming from, and they're seeking that the objectives and policies only focus on significant risks, do you agree or disagree with that?
I think
without, if we were to produce a series of maps in the CEP that matched the most significant areas of risk, then you could hang a rule framework from that. In the absence of maps that are based on risk, in my view, Chapter 28 needs to set up a framework and first to determine the level of risk through the consent process and then to find the right outcome in terms of that specific development being considered through the resource consent process. So, and the significance of risk is also determined by the nature of the activity being sought by the resource consent applicant as well, insofar as a residential activity might have a higher risk profile than a industrial activity in terms of the number of people who are being exposed to the hazard. So in my view, through the application of policy 28.3.2.3, which sets out the framework for the natural hazards assessment, that's at the point that you determine how significant the risk is.
Thank you for that. Paragraph 12.5, you've suggested a reference to climate change at 28.2. And this comes to a question I asked Ms. Scott. To what extent does the existing identification of natural hazards, for instance, flood hazard, take into account climate change effects? And does there need to be, again, this big assumption of the mighty scope, does there need to be a more general acknowledgement of climate change as an impact on natural hazard assessment?
Well, in my view, the application of policy 28.3.2.3, which sets out the criteria that it seems to be included in natural hazard assessment, would preclude somebody including climate change in their assessment. In my view, including climate change in this chapter, does bring that issue to the fore. And one of the benefits of having the hazards information in an external database and not mapped within the plan means that the information or the hazards information that we have can be updated more easily as our understanding evolves, including consideration of things like climate change.
Policy 28.3.2.3 would lead someone to consider climate change?
The frequency of natural hazard events, so bullet point one. The scale of the event.
Well, yes, but that's expressed in the present. Doesn't it have to be? Would it be useful for that to expressly include consideration of future changes? I mean, most scientists and the scientists who do this assessment risk rely on existing data.
Right.
And existing data only comes up to the present.
Right.
There's no looking into the future and predicting what might occur. And so they would look at that and say, well, the type and frequency of scale was only ever flooded up to that point.
Okay, so I take on board your comment.
Classically, a flood hazard map would be done on the basis of a statistical analysis of the historical record of water levels in the district. That's why I asked Ms. Scott whether the hazard maps of Queenstown Bay take into account future climate change impacts, or is it, are they, as I suspect is probably the case, based solely on where the water came up to in 1999?
Okay, can I come back to you on that, because I feel like I'm pushing beyond my expertise in terms of what the scientists include in their assessment. But if I can get some advice on that, I can come back to you.
Yes, well, I do think it needs to be in some productive development rather than purely system data.
Yeah.
I know that the team, in my experience on hearing consent applications here, the analysis always relies on existing data.
We have the learning to live with flooding, which is a joint document between us and Regional Council, and I believe that is based on historical data in this name. So that would be an example. But if I could take advice of that
and
come back to you.
Now, looking at your 1210, I did a double take at the statement that substituting the word minimised with avoided or mitigated would provide greater certainty, because in the various chapters of this plan, many submitters have suggested that the term avoid, remedy or mitigate provides sufficient certainty. I've had the discussion with a number of planners suggesting that if an objective or policy that uses the word mitigate does not identify the desired end result or the scale of mitigation, then it leaves it completely uncertain.
Right. Well, in my position, I have had such a shift to avoid or manage in the way I what I mean there is that the same meaning of the word minimised is to reduce it to the smallest possible degree, which is not, in my view, what Chapter 28 or the proposed study are trying to achieve.
Do I, just having reading the objective, is the answer, Robinson's question, that you've identified the endpoint that is a tolerable level, that any mitigation cannot be less than to achieve a tolerable level?
So,
because in this case it would be a less mitigation rather than more mitigation.
Yeah. So remove any reference to minimise.
I think that what the Chair is saying is that maybe your recommendation already addresses my concern, and I'm reacting to your reasoning. We'll put it another way, agreeing with them would be a good option.
I'm trying to help you.
But what I've taken from your answer is that minimise is not satisfactory, because that is the smallest amount possible, or maybe the smallest amount practically possible, and that's not in fact where you desire it to end up.
In my view, that's not the intent of Chapter 28, and I think looking at the proposed IPS policies that talk about avoiding significant increases in risk, in my view, that's not what
And the next drafting point relates to the next objective. it did say development where risks are avoided or appropriately managed or mitigated. You suggested deleting the or mitigated. On the basis that avoidance is a management mechanism, you're managing risk if you avoid it. Would it make more sense to say avoid or appropriately mitigate? Your 12.22, we're here talking about adding to the extent practicable. Whilst acknowledging the locational, technical and operational requirements of regionally significant infrastructure, aren't those locational, technical and operational requirements just an example of what might make it not practicable? Do we need the whilst acknowledging?
But not other infrastructure or assets.
Right.
And it may be without that on the end, that might be more helpful when you consider, for instance, extension of the council service plan in the Delta, and something such as that.
Yeah, and I'm just looking intuitively, narrative thought. Yeah, I'll consider that change, but I think that sounds like a pragmatic approach. And I reduce the scope of the.
Yeah, unintentionally.
Yeah.
But I think if you look at what the practical means, it gives any infrastructure provider the opportunity to point out those matters.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. the other question I have for you is that that policy needs to be referenced to natural hazards, because it doesn't actually mention natural hazards. It's framed very generally.
Okay, I'll
have to be reading it. That, because as I, in this context, I think the point is, it's to avoid or mitigate those risks
from natural hazards
that might occur in the event of a natural hazard manifesting itself. Like, that's not the language you would use in the policy, but that's what I understand the intent to be, but it doesn't say that.
Mm-hmm. So it says mitigate the future risk posed by natural hazards.
Well, that's the... Not in the book like that, because you really care, but also the risk arising from the infrastructure as a result of a natural hazard. The way it's presently written. For instance, an earthquake bringing down power lines or breaking sewage systems, causing a risk to human life rather than a natural hazard. Causing, I mean, I'm wondering what that's intended to capture, and that's, there's an element of ambiguity.
Your policy 28314, this is another one where I was puzzled as to what you're trying to achieve here. The first thing is, if either public bodies or the councils are exercising statutory powers, does it matter what the district plan says? If they have a statutory power, they're going to do it. I'm obviously missing something, and that in a sense the council can only exercise statutory powers because it's a creature of statute. It can't act other than in accordance with the exercise of a statutory power. So what's the underlying purpose, to your mind, of this policy?
Mm. Well, it puts the same onus on councils as it would on anybody else in terms of mitigating the effects that may result from the mitigation works that they undertake.
And the other question I had is that in acceding to the RPL or QPL submission, what about the other actors who hurtle into view whenever there's a natural hazard emergency? I think about Fort Hills fires, where the army's all over the show assisting people. You have the Director of Civil Defence Emergency Management, for someone who I didn't know existed until I read that act, that is there a danger by just referring to the councils that you might not have, well, it's the classic of any list, you've got to worry about whether the list is complete.
Yeah.
Or the Fire Service Commission, for instance, or the Harbour Master.
Well, the other question I have is whether it's concerned with words or actions. Because when I read it first, I thought, well, that's flood banks can be constructed, but they have to be in accordance with the general requirements of the plan. That was my first reading. Is it wider than those sorts of flood those sort of mitigation activities.
Yeah. I had considered in terms of symphonic or emergency, I asked state life on this, but I had to deal with there was other legislation that would give those powers and that would trump the requirements of the district plan.
Well, I suppose that's where I started. Of course, I was thinking, well, if they have separate power that is separate from the RMA, what's the purpose of the policy?
Right, in terms of an emergency situation.
Yes, and so that you also have the short-term, long-term thing. I don't think anyone's going to read the district plan when they run out and put sandbags out. But if they're going to put enlarge the flood protection works in Queenstown Bay as permanent, or there's a proposal to dig out Kawarra Falls to try and get water out.
So I suppose programmed works.
Yes, and so what I'd appreciate is you coming back and explaining to us when you've had time to talk about it, think about it, and talk to council. What is this trying to achieve? What situations is this trying to address?
Well, in my view, it's trying to address planned work, so programmed work, rather than hazard mitigation work that would occur during an emergency.
Yeah.
That's the intent.
Forward thinking rather than effect.
The last series of questions I had related to your 1238 about extending to urban development, so that's all, it covers all development, just get the right provision.
Which column do you mean?
What's that, sorry?
Which column, where are we in, sorry?
Good question, that's what I'm trying to find out. I should have written this down, I apologise for wasting everybody's time here. Please.
3-2-1.
I think you've solved it by putting a line through the acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
I apologise, as I say, for the tedious track through this.
No,
but,
fine. It's just
really good. I've got a couple more.
Yeah.
Just and these are on chapter 28 itself. In section 28.2, you've added the sentence at the end of the second paragraph, this is likely to increase with climate change.
Yeah.
Is it with or as a result of? And the other question is policy 58331. You've already mentioned this in your speech. As consideration for council's decisions, and I just wondered whether it should be more explicit and say for use when council is considering the decisions on resource consent applications.
Considering decisions?
In considering decisions yet.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it might be more helpful to be explicit as to my opinion.
No, I think
that's changed. Other than that, I have no other
questions. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
My report has collated those recommendations and has also addressed the remainder of the definition in relation to submission. For purposes of clarification, I have recommended inclusion of a number of notes at the beginning of the chapter that will aid the consistent interpretation of the defined terms in the PDP. I've also recommended a list of acronyms at the end of the chapter for ease of reference, same method. Included within the notes recommended within my section 42A report was a note clarifying that further definitions are provided within chapter 26, historic heritage, and that those definitions apply to that chapter only. For consistency reasons, I now recommend that these defined terms be relocated into chapter 2 with the preface under H, making it clear that the definition is applicable to chapter 26 only. All of these definitions were recommended to be inserted into chapter 26 by Ms. Jones, and I note that with the exception of relocation, the relocation definition, none of these defined terms overlap with the definitions provided in chapter 2, and that these recommended amendments are included in the appendix 1. Added to that, I heard your earlier comment about the definitions in chapter 12 and 13, which I've missed, and I would review the same for those. I do not intend to summarise all of the recommended amendments to the definitions, however, some of my recommendations have implications for the PDP outside of Chapter 2, and I cover these below. Mr. Craig Barr, in his evidence relating to Chapter 30, Energy and Utilities, rejected the relief sought by Transpower New Zealand to introduce a definition of reverse utility on the basis that the term is still being defined through case law. In response to another submission by the oil company seeking the same relief, I have recommended that the same definition is included in the decision version of the proposed RPS be included in Chapter 2. Of relevance to my recommendation is also the breadth of issues that the PDP covers in the assessment of reverse utility effects. For consistent assessment of objectives and policies in relation to reverse utility, I consider that a definition in the PDP would be of benefit. Submissions were received requesting changes to the definition of visitor accommodation in relation to the specific number of nights permitted and the like. I've recommended that this submission be rejected, as I have not been provided with any detailed evidence showing why an alternative time frame to 90 days is more appropriate. But I note that the definition is likely to be reviewed again in stage 2, and that these submitters will be able to lodge new submissions at this time. I also note that the standards such as the specific number of visitor accommodation nights permitted is more appropriately located within the zone chapter rather than within a definition. Plan change 49
to the IDP related to earthworks is made operative after the PEC is notified. Subsequently, there are differences between the definitions introduced by PC 49 into the IDP and Chapter 2 in PEC. Where submissions have provided scope, I've recommended changing the definitions in the PEC to be consistent with those introduced by PC 49. Council will need to consider the other earthworks related definitions when it notifies the earthworks chapter in Stage 2. The definitions of domestic livestock, residential slate and visitor accommodation are tantamount to rules. My recommendation is for the portion of these definitions that equates to rules be inserted into each of the relevant zone chapters. I've not updated each of the relevant chapters to this effect as they relate to chapters that have already been heard by the hearings panel. However, I am prepared to do so if the panel requests. The definition of domestic livestock addresses the keeping of poultry and animals in all zones. However, from review of the Stage 1 PDP chapters, I've identified that domestic livestock activity has only been included within chapters 21, rural zone, and 23, the Gisborne character zone. Limitations on the keeping of poultry in the residential zones in particular is important as the keeping of large numbers of poultry on smaller sites could result in adverse noise, odour or potential human health effects. Accordingly, I consider that a rule relating to the domestic livestock activity needs to be added into all of the Stage 1 zone chapters. However, there's no scope to do this through submission. So consequently, Council will need to address this within Stage 2. For plan interpretation purposes, I consider that the definitions of adjacent and adjoining would be beneficial, as they're often misinterpreted in the application of the IDP. However, there's also no scope through submissions to include these in Chapter 2, and the Council will consider addressing them in Stage 2 for District Plan Review. Numerous notified definitions included advice notes or notes. As this has no legal standing in the definition, I've recommended a number of changes. For those notes that include statements that are fundamental to the definition, I've recommended incorporating the notes into the definition. And for those that are for guidance purposes only, I've recommended their attention notes. In relation to Ms. O'Sullivan's evidence on behalf of the Queenstown Airport Corporation, I do not agree that a definition of airport operator is necessary, as the term is only used within the designation, which Chapter 2 does not apply to. In order to clarify that the Chapter 2 definitions do not apply to designations, unless specifically stated within the designation, I recommend an amendment to the notes at the start of the chapter as shown in the attached appendix. This point is further addressed, or has been further addressed, in the Council's legal submission. I also disagree with Ms. O'Sullivan that a definition of navigation activity is necessary within the PDP, if I consider that the ordinary dictionary meaning would suffice. I do, however, agree with Ms. O'Sullivan's other points in relation to the changes to the definitions of activity sensitive to aircraft noise, out of control boundary, and critical listening environment. I also agree with Mr. Sullivan in relation to the merits of changing the definitions of antenna and mast to extend your application to ensure radio communication, navigation, or meteorological communication activities are included so that the relevant rules in the utilities and energy chapter cover the appropriate activities. However, there's no scope through submissions to make this recommendation. However, I do note the previous suggestion relating to the radio transmission or receipt and can address this later in the road reply. With regards to Ms. Mann's evidence on behalf of the Ministry of Education and Southern District Health Board, I recommend the deletion of the community facility definition in the right of reply for Chapter 7, low density residential zone, following consideration of the previous evidence. The recommendation in my Chapter 2, Section 42, I report is entirely consistent with this. If the defined term is needed in Stage 2 because it is used in a related provision, it can be notified and submitted on in the context of Stage 2. For the reasons also set out within the Chapter 7, Section 42A report, I do not support Ms. Min's evidence from the Ministry of Education in relation to daycare facilities. The release sought by Ms. Blake on behalf of Real Journeys Limited and Tiana Developments Limited goes beyond just a change to a minor alteration of definition. The rules that would need to be inserted into the relevant chapters to create the needs of change to the definition suggested by Ms. Blake have been rejected in earlier hearing terms. I also note that the release sought was previously agreed by Ms. Jones to cover Section 42A for the Chapter 12. Mr. McCallum Clark, on behalf of Chorus, Spark and Vodafone, seeks that the definition of support structures be broadened to include telecommunication lines as the term is used within the definition of minor upgrading, which is naturally for Vodafone Chapter 30. With the recommended deletion of the definition of telecommunication facility by Mr. Spark and his evidence related to Chapter 30 for other reasons, consider that the release sought by Mr. McCallum Clark is necessary and recommend a change to these details in the appendix 1. I also agree with Mr. McCallum Clark in relation to the update to the definitions of regionally significant infrastructure and small cells to reflect the new regulations. Mr. Barr recommended the inclusion of a definition of small cells in the Section 42A report for Chapter 30 as a consequential amendment due to changes made in response to submissions, and the national standards have subsequently been updated. My recommendation in this regard is also shown in the appendix to the summary. I note that Ms. Bogle, in her Section 42A report for Chapter 16, Business Unit Keystone, addressed the release sought by Bunnings. However, I wish to hear this from presentation in relation to the need to amend the definition of retail before I make a recommendation in this regard. It has recently been brought to my attention that a submission point from the New Zealand Police was deferred in paragraph 6.17 of Section 42A report for Chapter 37 designation, and it has not been addressed in my report. The submission requests that the definition of community activity be amended to include police purposes rather than police stations, as this broader term would cover all police activities. I've had a chance to look at his pre-lodged evidence now, that was dated 13th of March by Mr. O'Leary, and he explained that police purposes would include community centres, training centres and supporting administration type functions. So I'll have a look at that further, but in principle I would support this change now with that further explanation. I've noted an error in the Appendix 1 attached to my Section 42A report, and that removal of a building is listed twice on page 2/29, and that they also differ. The first definition on the page represents no recommendation, but please write through the definition if you can find. Mr. Lawrenson for the oil company, his pre-lodged evidence does not support my recommendation in relation to the definitions of cleanfill or cleanfill facilities, because I've taken from Plane Change 49, and I'll need to review the evidence further in response to that in my right to reply. Also, Ms. Bold for Transpower New Zealand appears to be reiterating submissions previously addressed in the hearing on Chapter 30, so I will have to also review those further in the context of Chapter 30 and respond in the order of reply.
Before we ask any questions, we'll take out. We'll go to 10 to 4.